Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So, nobody blinked on Capitol Hill, and the bailout went down, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average and everything else right behind it. President Bush begging again today for action. Congressional leaders say they'll be back at it. What does Wall Street think about its great tumble? We'll ask, and we'll hear from Mr. Bonfire of the Vanities, novelist Tom Wolfe, on where the high-finance masters of the universe turn now. This hour, On Point, The View from Wall Street. You can join the conversation. What next? What now? And what's your message to Wall Street? In our next hour, we'll hear from Main Street. If you don't have it broadcast on your local station, get it at onpointradio.org. But this hour, it's Wall Street and Washington. Joining me first today from Washington is Greg Ipp. He's U.S. economics editor for The Economist. He's been reporting from Capitol Hill on Congress and the rescue that failed, at least so far. Greg, welcome.
Hello, Tom.
Is there still reason to think that Washington will produce a bailout, a rescue, whatever you want to call it?
Yes, there is, Tom. Congressional leaders and the administration are regrouping and trying to find a way to put the package back together in a way that it can pass the House. The Senate looks like it is intent on going ahead with a vote on Wednesday, and that would perhaps create some political momentum for the House to come back together and put it forward for another vote. The Senate leaders believe they have the votes together to pass the package. In the House, they only need 12 members to shift their votes, but it's hardly a guarantee that they can get those 12 votes because, remember, we're just 5 weeks away from an election. And any congressman who changes his vote now has to go back to his or her constituents and explain their about-face, which obviously their opponent is going to make considerable hay out of. And there are genuine philosophical objections to what's in this package. So I think a lot of the work in the next day or two will be finding perhaps some areas of give and take where the administration and the leaders can modify the bailout to satisfy a handful of members who currently are not comfortable voting for it.
Maybe. A nearly 800 drop in the Dow will help them convince constituents at home that it's necessary. Here's President Bush this morning saying it may not be pretty or fun, but the country's economy needs it.
As much as we might wish the situation were different, our country is not facing a choice between government action and the smooth functioning of the free market. We're facing a choice between action and the real prospect of economic hardship for millions of Americans.
Greg Ipp, does anyone doubt that that stark choice at this point that the president lays out there? Or is there some flight path here where there's no bailout, there's no rescue, and the economy somehow knits itself back together and moves on?
Put it this way, Tom. If there were those who doubted that dire scenario 24 hours ago, there are fewer of them after the 800-point drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average that followed after the defeat of the package. That said, there are folks who believe that, number one, yes, there are problems out there, but this bailout would not have adequately addressed them. Many economists feel, for example, that the administration would be much better off, rather than spending the money on the mortgage assets, putting it directly into the banks. And there are ways.
What do you mean by putting it directly into the banks? Just shoveling money into their vaults? What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, purchasing stock, either common or preferred stock, in a weakened bank, so that would shore up their capital base and enable them to meet their obligations.
So buy equity in the banks, don't buy mortgages.
Right. And that would actually give the government some benefit because if the banks actually end up surviving and prospering as a result, the taxpayer would share in the upside. And there are ways of accomplishing some of this. For example, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation can, with the permission of the president and the consultation with the Fed, do just that. And that's more or less what they did to try and broker the merger of Wachovia with Citigroup.
What has Hank Paulson said, okay, fine, we need a rescue here, let's buy stock, not mortgages? Is he on board with that? And if not, why not?
Well, that actually, Tom, was an authority that the Treasury would have obtained in the bailout package that went before Congress this week. Now, the administration has said that their principal focus will be on purchasing assets, but the law was actually carefully written to permit other sorts of actions, implicitly including purchasing direct stakes in companies if that was necessary.
I want to ask you how party lines break down on that. They broke down big time on the floor of the House yesterday. Nancy Pelosi, as they moved toward a vote, was very critical, talking about the Bush administration's policies being built on budgetary recklessness, anything-goes mentality, no regulation, no supervision. We heard more about that later. But here she is talking tough about President Bush. This is Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, about President Bush and the budget surplus first year that he inherited from President Clinton.
With his reckless economic policies, within 2 years, he had turned that around. And now, 8 years later, the foundation of that fiscal irresponsibility, combined with an anything-goes economic policy, has taken us to where we are today. They claim to be free market advocates when it's really an anything-goes mentality.
Nancy Pelosi in the House yesterday, and of course the votes weren't there. Then Republican Minority Leader John Boehner blamed her and that speech for turning some House Republicans, enough to make it fail, away from a yes vote.
I do believe that we could have gotten there today had it not been for this partisan speech that the Speaker gave on the floor of the House. I mean, we've put everything we had into getting the votes to get there today. But the Speaker had to give a partisan voice that poisoned our conference, caused the number of members that we thought we could get to go south.
Greg Ipp, what did you think of Nancy Pelosi's comments and John Boehner's blaming those comments for the failure of the bailout to go through yesterday?
Tom, I think given the delicacy of the negotiations and the fact that this is a package that basically makes nobody happy, it probably was regrettable that the tone that was struck in that speech did actually raise some partisan rancor. On the other hand, I think Democrats can rightly say, well, what Republican congressman can look their constituents in the eye and say, I sacrificed the good of the country out of partisan pique? I think the real issue here, Tom, is that the party whips had a job to do, which was to rally enough votes to pass the legislation that their leaders said needed to be passed. And the bottom line is that the Democrats actually delivered more votes than they promised, and the Republicans fell short. So at the end of the day, there's a lot of kind of getting your rolling up your sleeves and getting down and doing a lot of just nitty-gritty parliamentary work in terms of getting this done. And that work was not completed, which I think speaks to the whole fragility and delicacy of this issue. And you'll see leaders in Congress going back to that job, rolling their sleeves up again and trying to get it done.
It wasn't done in no small part because bazillions of Americans were on the phone and on the email to their congressmen and congresswomen saying, "No, we don't want this." Can you see some shift in the outline of the plan that might change public opinion toward it, Greg?
Probably not, Tom. I don't think the average voter is paying all that much attention to the detail of the plan. I think it's more important that the congressmen who have to vote on this and then defend it to their constituents have some kind of political cover in the form of concessions that say, I managed to get this out of the administration, and that's why I voted for it. The vote, if you look at the polls, people are roughly split between support and opposition for this plan, and a lot of it depends on how you ask the question. But the people who are opposed are very, very opposed and feel very strongly, and they're the ones who are writing and emailing their congressmen. And so the constituent mail that people on the Hill are getting is running heavily against the plan, and I think that's playing more of a role in their minds than what the polls are showing.
Greg Ipp, economics editor for The Economist, joining us from Washington. Greg, thanks very much. Hang on to your hat there.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Let me turn now to New York. And Jesse Eisinger, he's a senior writer for Portfolio Magazine, the glossy Condé Nast Monthly that is all about the big money world and Wall Street. Jesse Eisinger, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
There's a lot we want to learn from you, but take us first just to Wall Street and its response. You know, yesterday, many people saw that split screen. On the one side, the vote in Congress and the rescue bailout going down. On the other side, the Dow Jones falling like a stone. What was the mood in New York yesterday as Washington did or didn't do its thing?
Oh, well, it was grim. They're pretty shocked that Congress didn't pass the bill. There was a lot of pessimism, obviously, going into the vote. The market was down a couple hundred points already. Maybe that was in anticipation that the vote might be in trouble, but it also could be the sense that the vote and the bill wouldn't solve the problems. There are deep financial problems in the country and in the financial sector, and it wasn't clear that this bailout bill would even work to solve the problems, as Greg suggested earlier in the show. And then, of course, we've got terrible problems on Wall Street anyway, a lot of investment banks have failed and been taken over. Hedge funds are running into problems. So the mood couldn't be grimmer.
Jesse, you are a great observer of Wall Street. You wrote a year ago that there's an end of era feeling to the whole thing. That is Wall Street. What did you and other folks in the know on the street know then that the country's just learning now?
Well, there was a big party from 2003 to about 2006, especially on Wall Street. Wall Street was minting money. This was the most profitable period ever for the investment banks. Hedge funds were running wild. Their guys were making $1 billion more a year as hedge fund managers. There was extraordinary prosperity, but it was built on fiction. It was built on a housing bubble, and much more than a housing bubble. I think that people out on Main Street still think of this as something like a subprime mortgage crisis that was only affecting the people's homes, the people who had poor credit. But this was much more than that. It was a widespread global credit bubble. And that means that banks and lending institutions and investment banks were all lending to each other in extraordinarily new, complex ways through credit derivatives, through complex structured financial products, and they were also borrowing a lot. So the investment banks had enormous leverage, and that's what I noticed in late 2007, and a lot of my sources noticed that as well.
Leverage as in a whole lot of debt for what they held. We're going to come back and look at what happened to that and the culture of Wall Street, its role going forward. Jesse Eisinger with Portfolio Magazine. Please stand by there in New York. We'll hear later in this hour from novelist Tom Wolfe of Bonfire of the Vanities. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There's the closing bell on Wall Street yesterday, signaling the single greatest point drop ever, 777.68 points in one day. It was ugly after Washington did not pass a bailout, a rescue. Call it what you will. This hour, we're getting the Wall Street view of the meltdown, where it's headed, and how it's changing, has changed already, the street. And we'll hear later in this hour from novelist Tom Wolfe, who introduced us to Wall Street's Masters of the Universe in his 1987 The Bonfire of the Vanities. Jesse Eisinger is with us, senior writer for Portfolio Magazine, knows the street inside and out, and called all this end of an era, he said, a year ago. Let's get a call from Dubuque, Iowa, and Jennifer, you're on the air on the phone to Wall Street. What's your question?
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I guess I have a comment. We're just absolutely horrified. My husband's been working his whole life. He and we've been saving for our retirement and our kids' education, and seeing what Wall Street did yesterday, and see what the House did yesterday. We're just horrified watching his savings go down the tubes.
Jennifer, do you blame the titans of Wall Street? Do you blame Congress? Do you? I don't know. How do you see what's going on?
I guess I'm not very happy. I'm very, very disappointed at the way that we've had Wall Street take advantage of poor people. And I hate to see golden parachutes and all that. But on the other hand, it's like this is our future, and we've got to do something, and we've got to do something quick.
Yep. Jennifer, thank you very much for your call. Jesse Eisinger, we could have, you know, maybe 100 million versions of that call. What do you say in response? You've felt and heard and seen the anger of ordinary Americans against Wall Street and politicians piling on in the last couple of weeks. You live and work in the middle of it. Is that justified? Is it well-targeted anger?
I think it's, of course it's justified. I think that what happened on Wall Street was disgusting, and it was a loss of values. Now, you know, there are a lot of causes for this. There was an excess of speculation and greed, and there was a wave of deregulation. We have had 30 years of a pattern of deregulating the financial markets because we had a faith that the markets could solve societal problems and also solve our issues of allocating capital properly so that the economy would grow more quickly. And, of course, that was that aspect of that ideology is true, but we've just had an era where markets ran wild, and I think that Americans are disgusted. Now, unfortunately, Americans as a country, we're living beyond our means. We are borrowing heavily. We're borrowing with our credit cards. We borrowed with our mortgages, and that fueled Wall Street's excesses too. So there's a symbiosis here of excess. And but, you know, the problems on Wall Street were not the problems of people didn't cause this. The government didn't cause this. These guys caused their own problems by borrowing too much, by making speculative bets, by running rampant in markets that were unregulated. And now they're paying the price, and they should pay the price.
Nancy Pelosi blamed it publicly and controversially on the Bush administration, anything goes mentality, deregulation, you know, thoughtless deregulation yesterday on the floor of the House. What do you say to that?
I don't think there's much controversial about that at all. I don't think that the Bush administration is solely to blame for this. The Clinton administration oversaw a lot of deregulation as well, and they should have to carry the blame for some of that too. But we had a pattern. The Bush administration has put forward a deregulation mentality. The SEC was asleep at the switch. There was a message from on high that the SEC shouldn't really be paying much attention to the markets. The SEC looked the other way when the Wall Street banks were levering up, were taking greater risks. And so the idea that the Bush administration is to somehow to blame for this is absolutely correct. Now, they don't hold the sole blame for it, but and everybody shares a little bit, but the Republican Party has been the party of financial deregulation and mainly the party of Wall Street for a long time, although Wall Street – there are some big shots on Wall Street that support Democrats as well. But, you know, we've had a system that has emphasized the deregulation of the financial markets for 30 years, and now this is the – as I say, this is the price we're paying.
Let's get a call from Berlin, Connecticut, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate Congressman Joe Courtney, 2nd District, Connecticut, for voting no. Although he's not my congressman, I think it took a lot of guts for him to go against the grain and vote no.
You're glad he did it, Mike, even though the Dow's down nearly 800 points and President Bush says we could be in a deep trouble here in no time if we don't pass it. You're still glad. Why?
Well, you know, I think to do what they're proposing is going to artificially bring back the markets. It's not natural. It's not normal. I think it needs to settle at its lowest point, and we need to start over. A poor analogy, perhaps, may be the Mississippi Delta region. They played with it. They fussed with it. They changed it. They diverted it. And it can no longer be a hedge against hurricanes.
So let it fall, you say. Let it fall. And you're congratulating Congressman who did exactly that. To look at that, let me welcome into our conversation also from New York, Professor David Byme, Professor of Finance and Economics at Columbia University, just up the island there from Wall Street. David Byme, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you.
You hear our caller. He says, don't bail it out. It's not natural. It's artificial. Let it sink. What do you say?
I can understand his dislike of what's happening. I can sympathize with what he's saying. But I think that what we need to do, what the administration needs to do, what everyone needs to do, is clarify what the goal of this bailout is supposed to be. If the administration had given us a more clearly focused package, I think it would have attracted more support. Let me explain what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
A bailout is perfectly okay if it is focused on liquidity. Central banks have been providing liquidity to financial systems for 200 years.
Liquidity, cash.
Cash, turning illiquid assets into cash at fair value. That's what they do. They lend to banks against good collateral, and they also buy assets from banks at fair prices. doing that involves no particular cost to the government. And if the bailout is focused on that, I'm perfectly fine with it.
But Hank Paulson says we have substantial tools at our disposal, but not sufficient without this great ocean of money for a rescue.
Well, it depends on whether you're trying to rescue by putting liquidity in, or you're trying to give gifts to people who brought you the problem in the first place. Insofar as you're trying to fix solvency problems and just give away money to people who brought you the problem, it's terribly wrong. Now, I'll give an example. Suppose a bank has made a $10 million loan, and it's not paying, and it's worth something, but it's not worth 10. Say it's worth 6. Does the government come along and buy that loan at 6, or do they buy it at 10? If they buy it at 6, it's fine with me. Because then they're getting fair value for fair value. They're not really spending taxpayers' money. They're putting it into an asset that can hopefully be sold later for something close to the same. So they're doing what governments have always done.
But the bank may not have the cushion of cash then. It needs to go forward. We've got more questions. One from Master of the Universe Country, Greenwich, Connecticut. Matt, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with the esteemed economist from Columbia, and I think the analysis is correct. The problem lies in the fact that perfect information or rational behavior is not what takes place at the investment banks or at the hedge funds.
What do you know about them, Matt?
Well, as I was telling your assistant, I think as a former master of the universe who made his money in 1999-2000, which was entirely based on a NASDAQ rise and fall, which was entirely based on a lottery and a trend rather than any kind of savvy understanding of the markets, I got to spend a lot of time with money managers, private equity, and hedge fund managers, and I still do, living in Connecticut and going back and forth to New York. And my esteemed opinion, based on MBAs and Ivy League degrees, is at the end of the day, I really don't believe a lot of these wealth managers or hedge fund managers or investment bankers actually think globally or think intelligently. I think there's a great deal of psychological explanations that aren't being discussed in these discussions. We're talking about politics. We're talking about finance. The men who are pulling the triggers, mostly the men and women that are pulling the triggers in these markets are not thinking beyond a very myopic, somewhat truncated and arrogant view. And this, again, is very, very broad brush talking.
But they were supposed to be risk arbitrage geniuses. You don't read it that way?
There's no such thing. In my opinion, and again, it's just my opinion, I have not really seen mathematical, psychological, market-driven geniuses. I see a lot of let's make money as fast as we can. There was a great quote from one of the bankers that, look, I hope we can make our money and our fees before this house of cards falls. I see a great deal of irrational exuberance in trying to give your clients 30% returns when that's just not possible in these markets. There's so much leverage. There's so much a need to take your 2 and 20. That means the hedge fund managers need to get 20% of the profits they make for their clients and 2% of the money they raise. They've got to raise a lot of money to survive with their other friends, the Knickerbocker Club, and to survive with their friends in Greenwich and show these $200 million type sellouts. That it's just, first of all, the goals and the values of the definitions of success have gotten so out of control that to be a success in New York really requires an amount of money that no one deserves. And yet that's kind of de rigueur these days.
Matt, we appreciate the report from Master of the Universe Country there in Mansion Clogged, Greenwich, Connecticut. Jesse Eisinger, there's a self-described former Master of the Universe, made his nut, his big money. He's out, but he says there's no geniuses in there. It's kind of psychologically driven, and no wonder we're in trouble. You know, we have heard for years on this show from big economists saying that there's a wizardry of efficiency having been brought to the U.S. economy by what Wall Street was doing. No?
Yeah, and I think that the two bubbles, the NASDAQ bubble followed by the massive global credit bubble, should put a stake in the heart of the idea that the markets are telling us something, the message of the markets is right, that we really need to trust it. And I think that the ramifications of this are going to be with us for years. The Federal Reserve for a long time, Alan Greenspan said that the Federal Reserve shouldn't look at asset bubbles. It can't identify asset bubbles, and it will have to only deal with the aftermath of asset bubbles. That seems like a misplaced ideology now, and economists are going to go back and have to reevaluate the way they assess their jobs and the way the Federal Reserve should do its job. And the listener is absolutely right that the core of the problem is the compensation structure on Wall Street and at hedge funds and private equity firms, which is heads you win, heads I win, tails you lose mentality. So that's the cliche, and it's absolutely true. These guys make extraordinary amounts of money when things go right, and then when things go wrong, their downside is limited. And the investment banks gave away half their revenue to their employees, and investors went along with it because the world was good and these guys were making a lot of money. But they're not giving back that compensation. Of course, some of them lost it when their stocks went down. But they're not forced to think about making long-term deals that work out for their investors, work out for their clients because they get paid up front. And that was a very malign way of compensating people. And compensation is going to have to change in some way or the other. And in the UK, people are already talking about regulating compensation, and that may come to the United States. Mm.
We're talking about The View from Wall Street. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Newton, Massachusetts. And Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Yeah.
I had a couple of questions. I was hoping to get some comments from your guests. Thank you. And the first is, I'm wondering, is the fear-mongering that seems to be coming down from the top of the political spectrum, the president and others reaching the agreement for this bailout plan, is there a chance that it's creating a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way that, you know, they're making investors and people on Main Street scared, and we're going to kind of create this panic that's sufficient to get the politicians to pass a bailout bill that may or may not be needed. That's one piece. And I'm wondering, is there any chance that your guests know if there's any talk that there could be a real significant reworking of the bailout plan as it is, that would maybe, as people in the Times have suggested or whatever, maybe insure some of the bad debt versus buying it, and maybe put some actual teeth into the oversight pieces.
Yeah, Larry, let us pick those up. Professor Baim, first of all, Larry listens to the president, other congressional leaders, and says, could this be fear-mongering? Could their warnings themselves be driving down the market? And second, is there a chance of something coming out in this rescue package that would be, that would not just, you know, fill the hole in the side of the ship here, but actually fix it so that things would start sailing in a better direction going forward? What do you think?
Okay, well, first of all, as to fear-mongering, I think that this administration has been prone to playing on people's fears. In this case, though, I think there's plenty to be afraid of. And I think the market, in the absence of government support collapsing, is evidence that there's plenty of fear out there all by itself without the government doing anything. So it's part of a long cycle. As long as there have been financial markets, we've had booms and busts. We've had huge moments when people have gotten excited and made a lot of money just as we've gone through, followed by busts. This one is a larger version of that.
But we've been told we weren't going back to the Great Depression because we learned from it and we would never, never do that again. Does that confidence stand today, David Baim?
Well, I think that we're going to have to do something dramatic, something bigger than anything we've done since the Great Depression. I think, frankly, the bailout package is on the right track, provided it's not giving gifts to the people who brought us the problem, provided it's not overpaying for assets. I do think the plan is going to go back to Congress and get reworked, and I hope it gets reworked to make it clear that this is not permitted to give gifts to the people who brought you the problem, but only to give liquidity to any institution that needs it. Now, if the institution is insolvent, we'll close it down. There's nothing wrong with closing down banks. We know how to do that. We've closed thousands of them, literally thousands. There was 2,300 that got closed from 86 through 92 by the FDIC. We may be seeing a wave like that again. It's all right. The institutions aren't blown up and thrown away. They are closed. The shareholders are wiped out. The managements are fired, as they should be. The government scrubs them up and sells them to people who will run them better than the previous incumbents. That's okay. That's part of the process. We should let that happen.
Jesse, we've just got half a minute here before the break. Do you see a potential solution out of Washington in this next handful of days that would put things, you know, float things again and fix the problem or put us on a track to a fix?
Well, we have very bad timing for this crisis. We should time our crises better because this is right in front of the presidential election. I think that the bailout package will come out in some fashion. I don't think it's going to be the ideal package where we, what Professor was saying, where we buy equity, the government. That's the right answer, but I don't think we're going to get to the right answer with this package.
Maybe not this time. Jesse Eisinger, David Byam in New York, please stand by. When we come back, novelist Tom Wolfe, he wrote The Bonfire of the Vanities, introduced us all to Masters of the Universe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Getting the Wall Street view of the meltdown this hour, where it's headed and how it's changing, has changed the street. On his show on Monday, CNBC Mad Money host Jim Cramer said that the market's response to the bailout failure is going to be extremely serious. Here he is at the start of yesterday's plunge.
The real deal is occurring right now. The one I urged you to raise cash for all last week and the week before. The one I wanted you to buy gold because of. The one I said you had to have safety stocks, the supermarket, good stuff, the food and drugs, and dividend stocks for, because of the pain that's ahead.
Is that scary enough for you? And down it went nearly 800 points. We've been joined by Portfolio Magazine's Jesse Eisinger from New York, by professor at Columbia University David Byam, and right now from New York, novelist and social chronicler Tom Wolfe. He wrote The Bonfire of the Vanities in 1987, and we've been talking about his Masters of the Universe ever since. Tom Wolfe, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Tom, this is Tom. We're taking over the Tom.
Well, the Toms are taking over, but the Masters of the Universe you've written in the last couple of days, Tom Wolfe, have left town already. Where are they?
Well, I hate to disappoint people who would have a great fun gloating over their demise, but they haven't died off by any means. About 6 years ago, the original Masters of the Universe, as I described them, were mostly young men, women hardly figuring at all, incidentally, young men who were making millions, even people in middle level, working for investment banks, began to leave investment banking and go into hedge funds. Many of them today are, as of this morning anyway, still doing quite all right, making or holding on to lots of money. And a great many of them are in Greenwich, Connecticut. Greenwich, Connecticut has replaced Wall Street as the center of investment speculation in the country. Wall Street is like Broadway. It's an anachronism. Something you can look back on with nostalgia.
Tom Wolfe, you've been such a big chronicler of American life for so long. What do you make of what's going on now? Your Masters of the Universe may be safely ensconced in Greenwich in their $20 million mansions and on to fancy hedge fund stuff, but the whole country's out here now swinging on the end of this hook. What do you think's happening?
Well, you know, I said just a moment ago, I said, as of this morning, it so happens that today, September the 30th, is one of the four times a year that most hedge funds open up the door a crack and let people take some of their money out.
Their rich investors who may have millions in there can take it out today.
But they can't take it all out. There's what they call gates, a series of gates. Mm-hmm. There's usually a fixed percentage that you can take out at any one time. Your next opening will be December 31st. Now, that could be enough withdrawals today to hurt the whole hedge fund business, and they're running scared just like everybody else. But these are, I also hate to disappoint people by saying these are smart people. These are the smart young talent that was on the way up in the investment banks. They were counting on them as the new leadership, and they began resigning from profitable jobs in the investment bank, going into hedge funds. And they're so far insulated, but that could all change. And today will be an interesting day to watch.
No kidding, to see if that money goes roaring out of those same funds it roared into. But the heck with them for a second, Tom Wolfe. They've done fine. They've got millions socked away, you say. They've got their nut. What about the rest of the country? How do you read what's happening here? Is this the kind of the real end of era? Are we headed back into, you know, holes in the soles of our shoes and selling apples on the street?
Well, so many people wear sneakers that that won't be a problem. I am old enough to remember. God, I shouldn't even mentioned.
You did it already. We know.
I remember the Great Depression. I was very small, but I remember they used to call them hobos. We lived about a three-quarters of a mile from the railroad tracks, and the hobos would come through the neighborhood ringing, knocking on doors, asking for food. And I remember my mother would always give them a sandwich. I think our house was kind of marked somehow as somebody who would be generous. Mm. But in any case, it was a devastation to people personally that it's been unimaginable since then. Maybe you have this figure. The stock market lost 7% of its value yesterday.
Yes.
I honestly cannot remember how much the stock market lost in the great crash of 1929, but it seems to me it was at least 20%.
Well, just 1987, it was just about a quarter. So we've seen much bigger falls. On the other hand, this is 7% after other days of big drops.
Yeah. No, it's definitely serious. And, I get calls from people I know saying, I wonder if I'm going to have a job a month from now.
I mean, do we need a new – you're masters of the universe. You made fun of them. You gave them a lot of trouble in your novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, showed how greed could get them in real trouble, but it was their trouble in your book.
Well, one thing that a piece of wisdom that comes not from me, but from Joseph Schumpeter.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1920s, when the great bubble formed on the stock market, people in general in this country were not used to stocks and bonds. They were considered rather esoteric instruments that only the rich were able to play with. But Woodrow Wilson financed the First World War by selling bonds to Americans. Suddenly, this whole world opened up to them. Wow, stocks, bonds. But Schumpeter said that these financial instruments are evaporated property, meaning that pretty soon you're all much more interested in the pieces of paper than the underlying assets. Now, when a hedge fund forms, or even when investment banks start and private equity funds start handling these pieces of paper, another level of evaporation occurs. I call it evaporation squared. And then when the Blackstone hedge fund started selling shares in itself based on shares it's bought from others who bought shares.
You're a long way from the plow and the anvil.
Yeah, right. You lose complete track of what it is that's going on. Maybe I'm Pollyanna, but I do not think that things are going to be nearly that grim. There's an awful lot of money in this country still, and it's not all based on credit and mortgages and so on. I'm in my what I consider my third childhood. I've been pimping out my cars.
Yes.
I've pimped out a
pimping out your cars, Tom Wolfe. That's lovely. Like what?
I've taken them to the customizers. Mm-hmm. The cars are now, the interiors are entirely white. They take everything out and cover it in white.
As the dandy interior, as your white suits. Okay, we got a visual there.
And even the rims are white. It's great. I just take my word for it. These my two cars now, the two greatest cars in America. Well, no, I don't really.
But it sounds like you're now driving the wretched excess.
Well, when you do over your 96 Buick station wagon, that's not really terrible excess. But anyway, I've noticed since I got interested in all of this that there are hundreds of antique car clubs, of customizing clubs, and they have meetings, they have huge auctions. There's a lot of money, unbelievable amounts, and I do not think it's all going to disappear because of the geometric spins of Wall Street and credit. This, credit comes from the Latin credo, meaning I believe. And right now, we're running into a situation in which millions now no longer believe, and that can seriously damage credit. But I don't think it's going to seriously damage what's been built up by American industry and many other markets.
A word of encouragement there from Mr. Bonfire of the Vanities. Buck up, says novelist Tom Wolfe. Tom, it's always great to speak with you. Thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate you having me.
Tom Wolfe, author of The Bonfire of the Vanities. His forthcoming novel is Back to Blood, about immigration in Miami. That should be good. Let's get a call from Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold, you're on the air.
What a morning, huh? I am a simple old man. In 1978, I bought a house for $50,000. In 1979, I watched my assessment rise to $80,000. I had done nothing to my house. This was the beginning of what I called unreal estate. Now let's jump to today. I do not own any stocks, and my credit card is no more than $2,500, so I feel fairly comfortable, but it'll still come down on me. The hubris in politics and the greed in investment is beyond wording, okay? Why is Paulson dealing this? Why is he the cat that they got up to do it? He's part of Goldman Sachs. Isn't there a bias possibly here?
Just possibly. Just maybe. Harold, our time is so short. Let us take it right there. Jesse, we had Tom Wolfe there, and Harold reminds us, hubris, greed, never mind Washington for a minute. On Wall Street, those, I mean, you talked about a disgusting loss of values. How does this evolve? We don't know how to think about Wall Street without thinking of hubris and greed. And we've over many years now been kind of taught that you know, I mean, Gordon Gekko got sent up for saying it, but that was kind of good, that would drive the economy. I'm not sure Americans know how to think of their economy without that kind of engine at the heart of it.
I agree, but I think that this era is coming to an end. I think that the era was marked by this emergence of yuppies and Gordon Gekko and Bonfire of the Vanities and Liar's Poker, Michael Lewis's book in the 80s, and survived the 87 crash and the crash of the hedge fund long-term capital management and the SNL bailout and the NASDAQ crash and Enron and WorldCom. And I think now this is an era that has met its end. And we're going to come out of it, and there's going to be a return of social values, I think. Maybe I'm being a little optimistic. I think there's going to be a lot of economic pain to come before we get there. But I think what's going to happen is that very smart people, brilliant physicists and combinatorial chemists and computer scientists are not going to be driven into hedge funds because the remuneration won't be as alluring, and we will have people working on medicine and people working on global warming and people working on infrastructure problems. And so I think that we're going to emerge from this with different values. I'm hoping that that's the case, but I think it's going to be a very rocky, unpleasant road to get there.
Maybe that's the change we need, though it sounds wrenching along the way, as you say. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Charlotte, North Carolina, and Frank. Frank, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Okay, I was wondering how they determine who they're going to save and who they're not going to save because, you know, yesterday, I'm pretty sure it was yesterday, that Wachovia,
Citigroup stepped in with the government's help to save, encouragement to save Wachovia in your backyard.
Okay, but AIG was helped out just a few months ago, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, and I noticed that two high-ranking, one senator, Elizabeth Doe, and a congressperson, Robin Hayes, who's running for office right now, they own like $7 million in stock in AIG. And are people being bought out by who, you know, in Congress, you know, helped out by who in Congress?
Might have a stake. It kind of makes you wonder. Frank, we've got it. David Byam, what about it? If and when we get a package put together here, who gets saved and who doesn't? Lehman Brothers down, AIG saved. You know, Frank's looking on from Charlotte and wonders, you know, how are they going to decide who's left standing?
Well, we need a good system of understanding who's insolvent and who's not. If they're insolvent, they should not be saved. If they're insolvent, they should be closed. And we know how to do that. We've got a process for doing it. And in some sense, that's what we've just done with WaMu and Wachovia, though in different structures and different ways, those stockholders have gotten pretty much wiped out. The AIG stockholders were not wiped out, but the government would have loved to if they could have. They didn't have the authority to close down AIG. And so they they did the next best thing. They diluted them with a big equity stake and held them back. But they would have loved to shut them down and see an orderly liquidation if they could have.
Jesse, you talked early in this hour, and others have used the phrase in the last week, the end of Wall Street. Now, what does that really mean?
Well, there's a limited sense and a larger sense. The limited sense is that these investment banks, standalone investment banks, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Bayer, Merrill, Morgan Stanley, they're finished as investment banks.
The go-go, so, big risk takers who drove things.
Yeah, they did M&A advisory, mergers and acquisitions. What they did in the last several years is trade for their own book. They became huge hedge funds, essentially hedge funds, and because they couldn't really make money as broker dealers anymore,
mm-hmm.
So they used their balance sheets and took risks, and the risks took them down, took Bear and Lehman down, and made people very shaky. So Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs have now turned into bank holding companies. They're subject to the Federal Reserve regulation now, and no longer do they have this kind of business model. And they're going to have to find another business model which will be less profitable. But the larger sense is that this era of the masters of the universe, so these guys who have taken huge risks and move paper around, they make their money through speculation. That is a question, and my idea is that this era is over, but we'll see if the bailout package comes through and we have a short-term memory problem in this country, and maybe people will forget it in a couple of years and we'll be back to riches and heydays. But my view is that this era really will change and we'll have a new era of much more intense regulation, and especially if the government takes stakes in financial companies, because then it will just be untenable to give this kind of remuneration to these guys.
Well, we wonder just how the U.S. economy works without that hot Wall Street juice, that hot oil we've all gotten used to. Jesse Eisinger, senior writer for Portfolio Magazine. You're great, and we appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And David Byme, professor of finance and economics at Columbia University in New York. Professor Byme, you're wonderful as well. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
God save us all. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.